energy, energy!
I have energy, I just don't want to be here!
Thank you for listening to the Podcast-tastic Podcast. You are listening to Season 2, Episode 4. I am your host, Matt Paxton, and I am joined by not one, not two, but three people from Pure Nintendo Magazine, your number one source for all things Nintendo. You all remember James Higginbotham, the head editor slash public representative of Pure Nintendo.
It's nice to be back.
I am also joined by Pure Nintendo's Justin.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going pretty well. So what do you do for the company, Justin?
Well, I started the website, and I do the site design and the magazine layout and a couple other things here and there.
I deeply respect that web design aspect.
Thanks.
I am also joined by Pure Nintendo's newest member, Alex Schramka. I really should have probably asked that first, but...
Hey, everybody. No problem. It's Schramke. It's a weird German last name.
Schramke?
No worries there. Yeah.
All right. And Alex, what do you do?
I just kind of help out. I'm like the go-to boy when things get too heavy for us. I post articles. I do game reviews. Just whatever they need doing, they need help out, I'm there.
So you're kind of like the intern there?
Yeah, pretty much. It's a lot of fun, though.
All right. Now, before we actually begin, is anyone else getting married? Just want to get this out there, because last time, I didn't even hear him. Thank you, Skype. I didn't even hear Justin say he was getting married. I thought he said, James said he was getting married. I thought he said one of his crew was getting married. So that just went right by me. So I feel like a jerk, because the audio just goes, yeah, I'm getting ready to get married. And then you hear from me, oh. And then just silence.
I didn't think anything of it at the time. Afterwards, I was sad.
I felt so bad. I was like, wow. So, no one else getting married, right?
No, not yet.
No, already married.
Already married. Well, congratulations to you.
Thanks.
All right. I brought all three of these Pure Nintendo employees in here because we are going to talk about... how consoles evolve, and how much they base their future designs on their competitors. And I just want to make it clear, none of us think that these are cases of blatant copyright infringement or just, you know, copy-paste new console. And we're all in agreement with that, right?
Of course.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right, and this is all sparked, this idea for this episode was sparked by a recent interview on Game of Sutra with Satoru Iwata, in which he stated that being first to the console market is not important, but rather making a lasting impact on the market. And it just kind of made me think about, you know, how the consoles evolve based on, like, who came up with this idea and how successful it is. Like, in the beginning, you see, like, in the 70s, you see with, like, the Atari 2600 and its competitors, the ColecoVision, you can kind of see that joystick and then, like, the buttons. And that was, like, you know, 70s up to 82 before the great video game crash. Mm-hmm. And then we just kind of recover and we see, like, the NES and the Master System have these, like, this D-pad and like two buttons, and then we just slowly move on to a more curved design with the Genesis and like the SNES and then the Sega CD. And then you can definitely see a trend. I found a very nice picture online that has like it all charted out about kind of how these controllers evolved, and they're actually in the order like these games were released, so I thought that was really interesting. Did you guys, that's really hard to kind of put into words, like, how you kind of see these trends. Do you see it the same way now, or do you see it, like, one person does one thing, and you see, like, it come right after that, you see, like, almost a very similar idea?
Well, I can definitely see a trend going. If you look back in the beginning with the Tandy and the Atari, that's just when they were bringing things home. You know, before, if you wanted to play a game, you had to go to the arcade. And so naturally, their controller is based off the joystick. And ColecoVision tries to add way more buttons. It doesn't necessarily work out. And the controllers evolved to a way where there's a simple D-pad for movement. Less buttons, but they do more things. They're kind of square, and then they start to round out to be more ergonomic and more comfortable to grip. You can definitely see the way it evolves that way, just based on trying these different ideas, all these companies having different iterations, and you just adopt what works and get rid of what doesn't.
And it does seem to be like, you can kind of tell when there's a change, like you see the first one in there that's radically different than its predecessors, but then you see the ones who come afterwards that look very similar. And, it's definitely not a case. I don't think it's definitely a case of, like, well, it sort of is. It's like the competitors saw what works, and they're like, you know, that's what the people want. How can we implement that into our console and, you know, have people buy ours and enjoy our stuff?
Mm-hmm. It's definitely a competitive and innovative market, you know. The controller is almost like a new gadget in yourself, so it has to be designed with something new and something flashy to get your interest away from the older model. And so it's all about just taking what works from the newest one and then innovating on it yourself. So not only is it really nifty and convenient to use, but it's comfortable at the same time. It does what it's supposed to. It's a learning process, and we're still learning.
Mm-hmm. Well, we see with the Wii U's GamePad Pro and how that's looking like the new Xbox 360 and the PS3 controller, and it's got that ergonomic, it's got the similar button placement, it's got the similar dual joystick placement. And so I think there's kind of like a standardization happening now with these current ones. And even with the Ouya, the one that we see, the Kickstarter project, there's a little bit of the controller up there, and you're not seeing like this really unique controller or one that looks like, you know, an Android phone or something. You're seeing a controller that looks similar to the ones that are out there on the market now. So you kind of see these companies knowing that these are the ones that work and that people do not want this like radical new like play style.
Definitely. I think that was a smart move on Nintendo's part, because they have this new you could say it's a radical controller. We've had touchscreen before, but they're also having that Pro controller is kind of the fail-safe, so people who want to use that can feel more comfortable while still breaking the mold.
Yeah, this new innovation going on. And, I mean, people are skeptical about it, but just recently we saw Microsoft announce the Microsoft Glass, and they were talking about a touchscreen interface with, like, a phone to, you know, the Xbox 360.
Yeah, that seems pretty interesting. It'll be kind of crazy, because with that, you don't have one standard controller, because it can work with tons of different devices. So I'm kind of curious to see how that will take off and what it'll be able to accomplish, since it'll be on so many different, you know, hardware.
True. And I think I heard that the Glass is also going to be on, the App Store, the Apple App Store, which I thought was strange. I didn't think Microsoft would just kind of go into that. But they're doing that with Xbox Live as well, so.
It's a new age we live in, I guess. Yeah. All competitors joining together, Apple and Microsoft.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, it'll be interesting how Smart Glass works out. And, you know, it seems like it's almost, you know, it's a little bit of a response to the Wii U, I think. But I think it's kind of a response to people saying that Apple will get more into, you know, the whole AirPlay functionality that the iPad has with the Apple TV.
Mm-hmm.
Even Mountain Lion, you can look straight up to your TV now.
Right. So
Apple TV.
I think it's almost, you know, Microsoft, you know, preparing the way for, you know, Windows 8 and all of that, and making sure that their, you know, next gaming system will be, you know, styled around the tablet and the mobile interface, I guess. Because it seems like they're not really trying to capture the same sort of gameplay that Nintendo can do, because Nintendo is going to have joysticks and all the, you know, traditional gaming stuff that we're used to, and really the, you know, the Smart Glass is just of see it as more of a casual thing in that sense, which seems different to say that Microsoft's going more casual than Nintendo, but in case they are.
I mean, you can make a case that everyone's going casual.
Yeah, that's true. Well, there was even that quote today or yesterday where Sony was saying that they're going to come out with more family-centric games this holiday or something like that.
Right, they're going to... The family-centric genre is kind of neglected nowadays.
Yeah, so I thought that was interesting. I was like, well, now everybody's on the bandwagon. So.
Hey, what is that? So the industry's kind of changing. It's kind of different now. Instead of just playing by yourself, it's evolved to more of like kind of like a family fair thing. It's more social than it was in the early 8-bit days or so.
Exactly. Like, we saw this big trend of casual play with the Wii came out, and then Microsoft and Sony's like, whoa, it sounds like a cool idea. Look at Nintendo making all this money. So they came out with Kinect and Move. Now they're all somewhat on the same playing field. Everyone's looking at, like Justin brought up, Apple now and what they're doing. And like, well, now we got to compete with smartphones or Android. And so this is kind of what Microsoft Glass and kind of the Wii U, you can say, is their counteraction to the smartphone. Like, hey, why do you have something portable you can carry around with your hands, you can do multiple things with? Why do you need your smartphone? The smartphones aren't as cool as you think they are, basically, type of thing. That is, sadly, the big competitor for console games now is smartphones, which doesn't make sense to me, but it's true.
Yeah. Well, everybody has to have a cell phone, and a surprising amount of people will just kind of chill out and watch TV and pull out their phone and play a quick game. It'd be surprising how common that is nowadays.
I mean, but not only does that open up the market for, like, these independent game developers, but you're also seeing, like, revivals of the old games, like, ports of the older games being on your, like, smartphones. Like, on mine, I don't think I have any casual games. Oh, no, I have Jetpack Joyride. But besides that, I have Phoenix Wright, I've got Mega Man X, I've got Chrono Trigger.
Yeah, Chrono Trigger, yeah, so that was on there.
And those are great. I love those. And I love that my smartphone has them. So, I mean, and that's just kind of the positive aspect of that trend, I guess.
Mm-hmm. It's also surprising how many people haven't played those games. They seem like classics to us because they've been around for so long.
Yeah.
But how many of, like, the younger generation are just now discovering them?
And a lot of the younger generation has a smartphone, so it's smart for them to come out.
Mm-hmm.
On your smartphone. Yeah, a lot of smart in one second.
I have a confession to make. The first time I played Chrono Trigger was actually last year. I completely missed that game.
Oh,
that's alright.
But my friend let me borrow it. Yeah, my friend let me borrow it. I loved every minute of it.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I missed a lot of the games, and I guess that was the cool thing about smartphones again is, you know, it's letting me catch up with what I might have missed.
Definitely. And it's a lot cheaper, too, than, say, sometimes those games are really expensive. If you were to try to get Chrono Trigger on eBay or something, you dish out a lot of money.
Yeah. Going back to Wii U and the point, I think, Alex brought up?
Yeah.
About people wanting to play games while they watch TV and stuff, well, you can now do that with the Wii U, and that's the big push into the making. Like, hey, you can do the things on your TV and still be playing games. So your parents can be watching TV, watching cooking shows or whatever, or your wife, and you can be sitting there playing Super Mario Brothers on the gamepad.
Right. And we kind of see Sony doing the same thing with their transparring.
Yeah. with the Vita and...
Which doesn't work as well as they promised it would.
No, it's also a much more expensive option.
Yeah, no.
And that's the thing that's kind of a disconnect with Microsoft and Sony, where I think Nintendo's done a really good job, is they designed their whole system around it. You know, like with the Wii, every game supported the motion control. You know, not every game used the motions. You know, some games just use, you know, class controller or just use the Wii remote without any motion. But every game supported it, whereas when Move came out, when Kinect came out, you've got like, you know, 20 or 30 games that support it. And same thing with the Wii U. Nintendo is designing their whole system around the touchscreen controller. You know, every game is going to support it, where I see is the Smart Glass. It's really just going to be, if developers want to support it, you know, here it is. It's like Microsoft's just trying to cover all the bases. And I see, you know, Nintendo really just embracing it and be like, hey, we're investing everything in this. And, you know, I think that's really smart going forward, because you're not gonna have those cases where, you know, people, you know, can't run the game or something, you know, or have to have a specific upgrade in order to play something.
Yeah, like the Kinect was a $100 add-on to your system.
Yeah.
For a handful of games, so.
Yeah.
So, and then plus, you know, whatever it is to buy into the games, and then the other thing, too, is it's a hard sell, because you get people to upgrade to that, and it's like, well, I can't even use this on all the games I want to, you know.
Right.
I think we're, you know, the Wii U has a big advantage there going forward.
I mean, I think the big thing was for, like, Microsoft, and it was something that hit Nintendo hard, and its second half of the Wii's lifespan was, yeah, you can support the motion controls, but can you support them well, or can you support them well for third-party developers? And, you know, that was the hugest problem for Nintendo and the Wii, which it looks like they're rectifying with the Wii U, but, I mean, Microsoft and Sony don't seem to be able to, like, get past that problem. Because it could be, like, too expensive for, like, smaller developers, or even just many developers who are just trying to do the multi-platform game.
Definitely. The cost of developing has gone up considerably. You just got all this expensive hardware now, and you could do so much that it takes all this money to make a AAA title like that.
Yeah, especially one that supports, like, all these new control styles.
Yeah, it's amazing how many options we have now. All these different controllers. It's almost getting a little too muddled.
That's
yeah,
actually.
Like if you were a Microsoft developer, you probably have to have a small little team just to focus on the glass aspect of it, and then a team developing the game.
Right.
So it's going to double or so your production cost of that game if you were to go that route.
Definitely. And then you got to get a whole bunch of different people to test it. You know, some to test just the mobile aspects, others to test the console aspects. There's a lot that goes into it.
Yeah. And now we're seeing the trend kind of going backwards now with, like, again, you know, going back, we've seen the smartphone. We're seeing that these independent developers coming up making these, like, games that aren't too expensive to develop or playtest or buy. We have, like, the emergence of, like, the Steam, like, with the Steam sales. You know, the summer sale just came by us, and I'm sure a lot of people are broke now, but, you know, they bought a lot of games for all their money. And they're buying these games from these smaller developers, not just big AAA titles.
I think it's good to have that. We need, like, an outlet for those indie developers to get started, because they do bring some, like, new and interesting gameplay ideas to the table. But it's, like I said, it's so difficult to start up because it's so expensive. It's just good for them to have that kind of way to get out to people. It's just spreading new ideas, and you never know, that may become like the norm for a new type of game.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it is actually becoming the norm. I mean, yeah, the AAA games are great, but, I mean, Microsoft figured it out with the Xbox Live Arcade. You know, Steam, Valve figured it out with Steam. The Wii U seems to be figuring it out. They're going to have the Nintendo Marketplace. You know, every console now has, like, a small marketplace. And, I mean, that's that trend going on.
It's almost like that's, like, the spice now. If your video gaming was, like, food, the console itself and your AAA titles are your meat and potatoes. It's what you're familiar with, all those games, and you like it. And you got the marketplace to kind of add the spice to the food, and to add the different style of gameplays, all the experimental and indie stuff. If that makes sense.
Yeah, I
think it makes sense of that. I can't.
I think it's good too. You know, console publishers really like having all of these games. They can say, "Oh, we've got, you know, 2,000 different titles on our system," you know, and they can tout those. Xbox Live Arcade, you pepper, stuff like that. So yeah, I think it adds the spice and it adds just a whole plethora of options. And I think they're trying to combat some of the stuff that Apple's done with the App Store, where they're like, oh, we have 20,000 entertainment titles, and it's kind of a bogus number because it's like, well, entertainment is not just games. That could be a fart app or something,
Right. That's entertainment for some people.
Yeah, it's quality over quantity at that point. But yeah, I see. More and more console manufacturers are really trying to emphasize we need downloadable games. We need to, get new developers because one of them may have the next big thing and it may lead to a big franchise in the future and make them money. So I think it's good, and I hope Nintendo really embraces that with the Wii U marketplace. But
I think a good thing is where Nintendo's going with downloadable full-blown games like Mario Brothers next month.
Yeah.
Open up the door for the game I'm playing right now on Xbox Live is the Walking Dead series. A fantastic series, making Nintendo start doing things like that, where it's more of a bigger than a casual little smaller like Mario Brothers 3 game, but it's not quite a full-blown game. And they now download those more easily now because they thing. Before, Nintendo was only downloading these small little, maybe half a gig games now, but now you can get up to gig games or more.
But we're kind of seeing with the ease of distributing titles online, we're kind of seeing all the consoles, all the companies embracing that.
Yeah.
And like I said, that's definitely cool to see. It's just I can't imagine what the console market would be like now if, if the App Store didn't take off like it did. Or Xbox Live was a failure or something, we might have a completely different console. There just might be just nothing but $60 games out there, and the only way you can get them is Best Buy or maybe at a discount at GameStop or something, and, it'd still all just be the AAA developers.
Definitely. iPhone, iPad, all that, iTunes was definitely the pioneer for downloadable content. And once I saw that market worked, everyone kind of adopted it. And the free-to-play that Steam does a lot, too, is starting to get really popular, where you maybe get the demo for free, and then you have to pay for the full game, or you get the game for free, but if you want the extra content, you got to pay. All those microtransactions makes game companies a lot of money.
That's true. The trend in MMOs right now went from, subscription-based to... free to play online, and then you can just purchase content while you're on there. And then you were talking about free to play. What do you think is going to happen with the gaming market when the Ouya actually comes out? If it's a success, what's going to happen? Or if it fails, is everything just going to stay the same?
Well, it depends on how well it takes off. I have hopes for it because it seems like they have some pretty big names working on it. From what I read, they actually had one of the guys who helped develop the Kindle hardware over at Amazon. They got some pretty big names working on it, so I have high hopes that it'll do well. And I think it's going to be an indie gamer's a dream to develop on that, especially for... there's tons of people in college, like myself, studying game design, and the ability to be able to develop a game and have it projected on the screen with a controller, just like a standard console, is really exciting.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. The barrier for entry in the console gaming market for development is so high. You have to buy a $10,000-$20,000 development system before you can even start developing, whereas, you want to make a game on the iPhone, it's $100, and, you don't even have to have an iPhone, you just simulate it on your computer and, upload it to the App Store. So, something like the Ouya, where it's, you could have that content on your TV screen, and then, I don't know if they're going to plan on distributing, homebrew content or anything like that. It said it was hacker-friendly, or, do anything you want to the system, but it sounds really cool, and I think it's going to be a hit with techies for sure, and especially if it's that cheap. So.
If I remember, $100 gives you, the Ouya, and that's it's already open for you. You know, the developer's kit's in there, ready to go. You know, hackers can get in there and modify whatever they want. They can put content on themselves. I believe that's something they can do. So, yeah, it's just a completely open thing. And if that succeeds, do you think we're going to see, like, a decline in, like, the AAA games? Or do you think that's going to, like, stay the same a little bit? And then indie games are going to shoot up?
I don't think we'll see a decline. I think it will be used more for, like, a showcase. For, like, a developer to come and develop a game for Ouya and finally get its game out there. Full-fledged HD game out off the iPhone. And then some other developer, maybe Sega. Sega may see and be like, hey, we like this team. Let's get on the big, even bigger game. I can see we can get bigger AAA titles, but different, unique ones coming out of these indie films, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
I can almost see it as a marketing tool for the big AAA companies as well, because figure the Ouya might attract more of the casual gamers getting used to the style of controller, and the AAA titles could offer free demos of their games on their system and get people, new customers that way.
Yeah. It's a great way for small developers to sell their games to bigger, like High Voltage, those guys, they worked under Sega for the Conduit. And they had this pitch and sell their idea to Sega. Now they can develop the game and be like, hey, help us produce this, help us finish it, or whatever they need. And then Sega or Capcom, Square Enix can all pick up and help these indie developers, throw money at them, and help them finish and develop a better, more awesome game.
Right. Just on a quick tangent, you mentioned the Conduit. Have you seen the ending to the second Conduit game?
Yes. Yeah.
That's amazing. I went to see the end of that trilogy. I didn't play the first one. I didn't play the second one, but I saw the end of the second one, and I want to know what happens next now.
Yeah.
Does Abraham Lincoln, you know, destroy the aliens?
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely think, like you said, James, it'll be, you know, a nice place to showcase for indie developers, maybe make a name for themselves almost. Because, I mean, for the most part, you know, where do, you know, normal gamers, you know, people who are playing on Xbox or PlayStation 3 or Wii or Wii U, you know, where are they going to play indie games right now? You know, they'll play it on their computer, you know, some of them, you know, may see some news about, like, Indie Game Developers Conference or awards and stuff like that. But for the most part, there's not a whole lot of exposure to the indie game community except through things like Steam. So I think with the Ouya, I mean, you could potentially have, you know, people that have entered these contests, these indie game design contests, and then, you know, have, like, 5 million downloads on Ouya versus, you know, only getting, like, 200,000 downloads through something like Steam, you know, where it's kind of just a niche segment. So, I don't know, I guess it all depends on how far and how successful Ouya becomes. So,
I think that success will be determined by the quality of the games.
Yeah.
Because it's great to have, like, tons of developers, but you always have to be careful of the shovelware.
Yep.
Which is a problem with any marketplace. It's plagued all the systems.
Yep. Yeah, even iOS right now, you know, you know, there's so much, you know, it's hard for developers. Sure, it's easy to develop for, but it's hard for them to distinguish their apps or their games on the App Store. You know, it's like, oh, there's 500, you know, types of, you know, shooter games or, you know, on the iPhone. So, you know, I think, yeah, you can definitely have too much of something on a system. If they can emphasize the key content and really good games on there. And it all goes back to the same argument, you know, how does the system succeed in the first place? You know, it usually comes down to the software. You know, if the games are compelling, people will buy the hardware, no matter what.
Now, do you think that, you know, if the Ouya is successful, we're going to see the other consoles, we're going to see, like, Nintendo, Sony, and Microsoft, like, modify their virtual store to compete with Ouya?
Well, I could see them at least modifying it in the sense that, you know, make it more open. You know, if they see that that's the trend, hey, developers want an easy place to make games for, and gamers want, you know, access to all of these games, then I could see them opening it up more. But I don't see them, you know, releasing, like, or, like, dropping their price really low and then, you know, doing free-to-play type downloadable games anytime soon. But, I mean, that's the way some of the third parties are going, so it's a possibility.
Yeah, like, I don't really see it totally taking over, like, taking away from the other app stores. Like, I can see it's a good place to develop for a game. Even developers, they have to pitch it. They got to sell it to Nintendo. They got to sell it to Sony. They got to sell their game. Make it worthwhile to be on the eShop channel or Xbox Live. So now they can be like, okay, here's our game. Here we've got 30,000 downloads here on Ouya. And Nintendo could be like, okay, that's cool. People like it. There's only 200,000 people that have Ouya right now. So that's a good percentage. We'll move it over to the eShop channel. And there you go.
Yep.
On smaller games with the big 8. But even with, now with the Wii U coming out, with more HD graphics, you can get more of these indie games with HD graphics easily moved over to different systems, to the Wii U, the 360, because you have 720, whatever they want to call it. But I can see it helping everyone all the way around.
Yeah.
Now, do you think something like that's going to happen even if the Ouya is not successful? Like, say the Ouya is kind of like, it's there for 3 months, and then it just kind of falls flat. Like, are the other companies going to see that, and they're like, well, we can probably take this aspect and kind of make that work and just try something themselves, or do you think they're just going to be completely unaffected and be like, well, they completely failed. Why reinvent the wheel?
Yeah, well, I could see them adapting some of the ideas. You know, let's say it doesn't fully work out, but, you know, some of the aspects of opening up their eShop to, you know, user-generated content or stuff like that, and fans really like that, so they're like, hey, well, let's adopt that at least. You know, some of their other business models didn't work out well for them, but I could see at least, you know, in worst-case scenario, at least some ideas will transition over to consoles, you know. But in the console space, it's so much slower, I think. You know, they plan for 5-6 years, so I think if they did do something like that, they'll stretch it out. They'll say, oh, in 2 years, we'll do that. And you know, 4 years down the road, we'll have another incremental update or do something. So, you know, I hope that speeds up, but I can see that being a slow process.
Yeah, anything in the entertainment world, people are somewhat afraid to try new things until someone else tries it. You have fails or succeeds. That's one thing I can say probably why we love Nintendo so much, is that they're not as afraid as everyone else to try something new.
Yep.
Even if you look at movies, let's look back in the 90s, superhero movies suck. And if they came out, they didn't do very well, they weren't big blockbusters, one until Spider-Man came out in the early 2000s when it made $300 trillion, that people were like, oh, we can make money on this. That worked. And so this idea worked. And now then when you come, Batman came out, Dark Knight was a more darker, edgier superhero movie. That worked. And so we get a lot more darker, edgier superhero movies. It's kind of like people are waiting to see, like, even when we came out, all this casual idea worked. So everyone else jumped on board. And then now maybe this whole, the smart glass or the Wii U thing, if that really does take off, people are like, oh, this is a great idea, we can do this. And then this indie thing takes off. So people are waiting to see what happens. People are, because they want to invest a bunch of money and fail, look dumb.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, going back to what you were talking about with that Iwata quote about, you know, being first to the market isn't necessarily important to Nintendo, you know. I think that that's kind of related to this in the sense that, you know, if you have a good idea, if you have an innovative idea and you're fully invested in it, it doesn't really matter if you're first or not. If it's successful, then, you know, people will see that, and you see the effect that the Wii had on 360 and PS3 with Move and Kinect. So I think with the Wii U, them being first, they're like, well, it's not important for us to be first, but, you know, if it works out and it's successful, then we're at least 3 years ahead of the competition on that front. But then if you go back a generation to the Dreamcast, they were first, you know, they came out a year before PlayStation 2 and 2 years before Xbox and GameCube. And you saw in that case, first was definitely not the best for Sega there. But
nah. In many ways, you kind of, the first to the market and the next generation is kind of like the riskiest position to be in.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I'll just put in my two cents. I think it's definitely, you have to plan it very carefully if you're going to be first to the market, because there are so many mistakes you can make. If it's too expensive, nobody's going to buy it. They know that the other consoles are coming out, so they'll say, oh, well, I'll wait for the cheaper one.
And that's one reason I think Nintendo is keeping quiet exactly what their plans are. I think they're still trying to feel out exactly how everyone's going to react, what they need to do, what they can do, what they can't do. For the 3DS, they kind of were like, it's 3D, here it is. And it's kind of threw that at us. And first we're like, yay, and everyone's like, oh. But now Nintendo's like, okay, here's a little bit of this. What do you guys think? How's the world feeling about this? And I think it's one reason they're staying very quiet about what the plans are for.
Yeah, they're definitely learning from their 3DS launch what not to do in this market, because it is very different because the economy is so tight and people don't want to shell out as much money.
Yeah, they didn't want to shell out the $250, especially with, again, with the smartphones and smart devices out there that can kind of do games. And then we just got like this $250 device, which is now down to, what is it now? 190, 170?
170, I think.
Yeah, so I think the perceived value, to like general consumers, they go into a cell phone store and they can buy a, super fast iPhone for, $99 or $200. And then if you have a system that's $300, they're like, well, that doesn't make any sense. It's not worth it to me. I'll just play the games on my iPhone. It's already an expensive piece of technology. And so I think the perceived value is where they have to get to. When they came out with $250 and with a 3DS, people were like, no, that's not really a value for me. There's not enough games. It's not compelling for me to pay that much. And same thing with the smartphones. Hey, I can buy a $99 smartphone and play, most of what I want to play. So, anyway, sorry, Jim.
I was going to say that value, I think what Matt and I talked about a little bit last time, came from, it was actually kind of all our fault.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at you, Justin. Is when the 3DS was first announced, it was crazy. It was a buzz. Even game developers were asking us, hey, have you guys played the 3DS yet? And we're like, they seem excited for it. And so Nintendo took that.
So much buzz.
Yeah, so Nintendo took that and they're like, oh, we can get away with $250.
Yep.
And they didn't really test that, and honestly, they couldn't get away with $250.
Yeah. Yeah, but I remember that E3 when they were, before they even announced price or anything, they were even putting out feelers on a price point, and they were saying, $200 to $250, and people were like, oh, yeah, that'd be great, we'd pay you anything, I think of that animated GIF that has Fry, and he's like, shut up and take my money, sort of thing.
Right.
I think we were all doing that. Shut up and take my money already,
And then I remember when they announced $250, we're all like, oh.
Oh,
it's a little high.
We're still like, oh, we'll get it, but it's still,
I like how you're just still reluctantly buying their stuff instead of full-heartedly. You're like, yeah, I'm kind of disappointed, but I will take it anyway.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think the 3DS also, when it actually launched, that was near the end of the hype of, 3D technology. Because, when the 3DS was getting announced, that was when, 3D movies were all over the place, and then, Sony and other companies are coming out with, these 3D TVs.
Yeah.
And you're kind of seeing that, and then Nintendo comes out, and they're like, this is 3D, but it's also glasses-less 3D. And people just got really excited about that. But then when people started to figure out 3D didn't work, people got way less excited, and then $250 came out, and people were like, oh.
I think it was kind of a, I don't want to say spur of the moment, but an opportunistic time to innovate their handheld system. and I don't want to say we lost interest, but it didn't necessarily work out as they planned.
Yeah.
That's true.
Did anyone see the quote from Iwata? It was somewhat on the same line where they were asking about the specs of the Wii U. And he was like, yeah, we don't really, Nintendo doesn't really care about power. It's when people have fun with their systems. Which has almost been Nintendo's motto their whole existence, is they don't really care about power or being first or being last, as long as people are enjoying and having fun with their system and making memories with them. I think Miyamoto said that a lot of last E3. He wanted people to have memories and share it with each other. And then Iwata, I think, said the same thing this past E3. That's Nintendo's whole motto, is they want you to have fun. They don't care if they're first or last, if they're the weakest, you know, spec-wise, as long as you're having fun, that's all they care about.
Mm.
Yep. I think that's their strongest point. They're very focused and to the point on their consoles and what they want it to do.
Yep, and I think that's Nintendo's strongest point overall, is, you know, they try to innovate. You know, every single generation, they're always looking at something new. You know, they never do the same thing twice, usually. You know, you look at Sony and they have the same controller for the last, you know, three PlayStation. You know, who knows if they'll do the boomerang for PlayStation 4 or something, but, you know, I guess for them they found, oh, we'll just keep consistent and that works for us. But I love how Nintendo's always pushing the envelope, always wants it to be fun, never satisfied, basically. And I think that stems from the fact that, you know, they're the only one that still makes systems, you know, only video game systems. You know, Sony and Microsoft, they've got, you know, other sources of revenue, and, you know, sure, they want their systems to be successful, but they're not willing to take those risks. Whereas Nintendo, you know, this is what they do. You know, this is all
they live or die by their system.
Yeah, if their consoles flounder, that's it for Nintendo.
Right, yeah, exactly. So, and I think Nintendo's even said before, you know, the day we get out of the console market is the day we get out of video games altogether. You know, and I think that's true. It's like, hey, we're, you know, in it, you know, 100%, and if it doesn't work out, then, you know, we're not going to half-ass it, you know. So.
Right.
But it takes a company like that to make the industry grow as a whole. You gotta try new things, otherwise you get comfortable and it gets stale and it gets boring.
Yeah, and I think you could easily ask Microsoft and Sony, you know, why they're focusing on the casual market, and they'd say, well, Nintendo, you know, expanded the market for us. You know, Nintendo's strategy with the Wii was, hey, let's not go after this, you know, same market that Microsoft and Sony are going after. Let's expand it, and if we get 50% of our new market, that's still 200% more than, you know, the market that Microsoft and Sony are going for. So I think, you know, they would give credit to Nintendo in a lot of areas. And you can see it throughout, you know, the video game history of controller innovation, joysticks, analog sticks, buttons, things like that.
Hello, everyone. We're back with the second segment of Podcast Tastic. I am rejoined by all three pure Nintendo workers, and for this section, we're going to try something a little bit new here. We spent the last 45 minutes, you know, intensely talking about consoles and gaming, so we're just going to spend this a little bit unwinding a little bit. Anybody want to start out with something they want to bring up, something interesting they reviewed or something, you know?
I don't know where to start.
So much pressure.
So much pressure.
I've been playing a lot of Xenoblade Chronicles lately. And you were talking about Chrono Trigger earlier. And I have to say, Xenoblade is probably the best game in that style of Chrono Trigger that I've played since Chrono Trigger. It's pretty amazing. So if you guys haven't played it, you should check it out.
And buy it from Nintendo, not GameStop.
Yes.
I
GameStop will sell you new games that are used.
I found that I can't down talk GameStop anymore since they kind of helped us out with the charity event last year.
That's good.
GameStop's great.
Go GameStop.
Yeah, they do some good stuff.
But I mean, the people are pretty cool there. But I haven't bought a game, like a new game, in a good while. Not since Skyward Sword, I guess. I'm not that much into income, so you could probably take a look at that on the 310 site about games I review. I kind of review older games or just iPhone games. So right now we're kind of like the poor man's video game review section.
And that's
It's like, this game is only $3, so I can review that. And,
that's a good discussion topic, too, what do you, if you're a console manufacturer like Nintendo and you're considering price, do you consider, the fact that people, have to invest a lot, to get a system and the games, what that means for, like, downloadable games in the future, are they going to discount games, people download versus retail, are game prices going to stay at $60, or are they going to come down, go up, and what that means for, gamers that can't afford that,
Right.
And then some of the talk about, Microsoft and Sony were kind of mulling around no used game sales or something, always having some code tied to an internet account or something like that.
So you had to pay like $10 to $15 to activate a game or something.
Ooh, we don't want that.
Yeah. I mean, like that sort of stuff, sucks.
Once I pay for the software, it's mine. I can do what I want with it, darn it.
Yeah, exactly. So.
I don't know about do whatever you want, because that just goes into the multiplayer stuff, and then you could just end up, that's one small step away from being one of those jerks on Mario Kart Wii who figured out how to hack the game, and now they're always in Star, and they're all huge, and they're shooting bombs at everybody.
Well, we won't go that far.
Not whatever you want.
Almost whatever you want.
Right, yeah. There's more freedom.
That game, Mario Kart Wii, I think that's the most game, or most online game I played, was that one.
Yep. I think that, I think I played that more than I even played Smash Brothers Melee local multiplayer.
We're not talking about Smash Brothers online.
Yeah.
That was some laggy gameplay.
It was horrible.
Yeah. I actually played that recently, but I think it was just me and a couple other people online because it was fast.
Well, hopefully they're listening to this and they will fix it, because that has so much potential.
Yeah.
I think they'll...
I liked what you were mentioning earlier, James, about Nintendo wanting to give you memories or good experiences when you're playing games. I really hope we get more of that. Kind of like with the 64. Like, I remember playing the 64, at friends' houses, like GoldenEye, like All Night, or, Perfect Dark, or, whatever other games we were playing, but...
And the GameCube, we used to have a lot of Melee and Mario Kart.
Yeah, I mean, we would always get together, like, one of us would bring the GameCube over, two of us would bring a couple more controllers, because we only had one controller between all of us or something like that. So I hope there's more of that, and I hope that, you know, the Wii U controller, you know, they're trying to do that, trying to, you know, get everybody in the room playing again, so I hope that happens.
Yeah, to me, that's multiplayer more than the online stuff. It's the interaction with people in the room.
Yeah.
But to me, those are the best memories you can make gaming, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, because most of my experience with online games has been, oh, okay, I've got to get my microphone set up. Oh, can you hear me? Oh, hey, what are you doing? Oh, I've got to go. You know, like, you can only play 20 minutes or something.
And most likely you are the worst person online playing.
Yeah.
Yep. No doubt, that's me.
Yeah.
Not to mention the 7-year-olds that trash talk you too.
Yeah.
That's always fun.
Yep.
That's where they have the mute button.
Yeah.
I guess that's a good thing about the Wii, so you don't hear anybody.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody bought that. I know Nintendo came up with their microphone system. Was it just called Wii Speak or something?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually really cool. It worked really well.
We used it for Conduit 1 or 2, James.
1, yeah, with the high voltage team we played that.
Yeah, and that was pretty fun, but yeah, it was, I think that suffered from the problem, you know, that like Sony and Kinect have, where it's like, oh, there's only 5 games that support it, or 10 games, or whatever, so.
And I think it was too public, like, everyone can hear the conversation, and it's not like, you know, with the Xbox or with Sony, they have personal headphones.
Yeah.
It was kind of open to the whole room, so whatever noise was happening in the room, or I was speaking.
Yeah. It's like you could at least shield everybody from the sounds going on in there. You didn't have to talk much, but...
You could have a 70-year-old person in your ear instead of coming out of your TV.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I can't imagine the embarrassment of that. If you have company over and there's just a 7-year-old just smack talking you and everybody can hear it,
it's gonna be awkward.
Yeah.
And embarrassing.
Yeah, exactly.
Because what's your response? I mean, it's just nothing short of, where are your parents? And then you shake your finger at them thinking they'll see it.
Yeah. What do you guys think of? I was looking at something today about. You know, different games, different generations. You know, we kind of talked about how, you know, people are buying Chrono Trigger and some of those, you know, companies are re-releasing those games for a younger generation. I was seeing something where people's kids people that played Pokemon Red and Blue, their kids are now wanting to get into Pokemon and they're playing the new games or whatever. I was just wondering what you guys thought about that,
I'm for it.
I mean, well, sorry. Story. I'll go on ahead.
Sorry. No, you first. You first.
I said this little story I had with that was when they released Ocarina of Time 3DS. I was like, oh boy, another Ocarina of Time I gotta buy. I've got like 6 copies of that game.
Yeah.
But my little brother had never played it before. And so I partially bought it just so that he could play it and experience it for himself. And so that was kind of cool to be able to share that, because I have such fond memories of that game. And I think so many people do.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, my first gaming memory is probably of Super Mario Bros. 3. And just out of pure coincidence, but also it seems like territorial now, I was playing it on the Wii, and it's, you know, the NES one from the Virtual Console. And my nephew's with me. He's like 2.5, almost 3, you know. And, you know, I went through that whole game. I did the warp whistle thing. So about like 20 minutes later, I'm at the end of the game. And my nephew's getting really into it. And I'm like, oh, this is a pretty good time. And then my sister comes in, and I look at her, and be like, all right, just to let you know for the record, Super Mario Bros. 3 is going to be your kid's first video game memory. I'm making sure of it.
Yep.
Excellent.
Yes.
Awesome. So
it was weird. When that game came out on Virtual Console, I hadn't played it probably like 8 years. And I went the first 2.5 worlds without dying.
Wow.
Because I played so much as a kid. Like, I had the first world memorized by heart almost.
Yeah, it's almost like muscle memory.
Exactly. because, you know, back in the NES days, you couldn't save, and so we thought I turned on the game and saw a little more of one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I played through that a million times. Of course, my memory's faded in the later worlds, and then I started dying pretty quickly.
Oh, yeah. Especially World 8 and Mario Brothers 3. That game's pretty brutal.
Oh, that's ridiculous. I mean, especially when you go into the dark area.
Oh, yeah. It's insane.
Yeah, like that was the worst. You can get past the first lava area, and then the flying ships, airships level was pretty ridiculous.
I always saved one of the P-Wings for that one, because I had such a hard time with the airship.
Yeah. That was the strategy.
Yep, I would do that too, and I would just keep tap, stay up in the air the whole time.
Yep. I actually found the way on the boat level of that. Uh-huh. You can actually swim if you're really good underneath the whole boat, the whole level.
Yep. Yeah, I would do that one too. That was a cool one.
I did that.
I love how it's lava, and it doesn't act like lava. It's like Kool-Aid.
Okay. Is it lava? I mean, there's been some debate about that.
Yeah. It definitely didn't kill you, so...
What did they say it was?
I don't know.
Some people say it's mud, some people say it's blood, you know. I don't think it's lava.
Nah.
I'd go with mud. Or just dirty water or something.
Yeah.
So, something that... I don't think it's blood. Otherwise, it's just Mario took a really morbid turn somewhere.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, I know.
But, you know, I'm glad these younger kids are kind of getting back into gaming. Or the old school gaming, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
There was such imagination back then. Because it was still so young. And we were still discovering our genres of gaming. What we could and could do. Instead of all the rules. So you had some fantastically imaginative games.
Yep.
And something just hit me. Is I feel like I'm getting old. And I look at now all the gaming now, and I keep thinking back to playing the NES, and so we tend to think of all the great memories I had. I'm like, I don't have that great video game memories now. Maybe, hopefully, the Wii U brings it back?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I hope so.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I hope so. I think a big part of it, too, is our generation is so nostalgia-based that... Yep.
That's where these indie games would come in, because once I'm going to name drop Joel's again, a Renegade Kid, people close to him, he's a nice guy. Mm-hmm. But even Muds brought me back to that nostalgia of old NES games.
Yep.
It was a fantastic feeling. It felt like it all could come right out of the NES. I loved it. And it's the first game that I've actually given a 10 to in about five or 6 years.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's such a fun game.
Because it brought me back to that nostalgic NES, possibly Super Nintendo, type era.
Yeah.
I think what will do that for me, besides, you know, Mario games, would just be like more platformers, or just even the most random games. Like, where's Joust? Is Joust coming back? Are games like Joust coming back? Are games like, there's this like 4-pack of NES games you could buy. And it was like just this most random thing where it was like Robin Hood. There was one where you played as an egg. There was one where you're like a guy in like a grass skirt and all he had was a boomerang and he was like socking kangaroos with it. Like, where are these games? I want to see these comes back.
Seriously, that's where all the fun's at.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, I think I read about this ages ago. It was a newspaper article. I can't remember the name of the company, but a bunch of guys who used to develop for Atari actually got together, and they were doing arcade-style games for, like, the iPhone.
Huh.
Oh, yeah, I heard about that. I think that's out now, actually.
Huh.
Yeah. I'd like to see what they come out with, because they said they were going into it with the same mentality as they did back then. It's just lots of iterations of different games really quickly at 25 cents a pop, you know, trying to bring back that arcade mentality.
Cool.
I think Adventure, that old dungeon crawler game for the Atari.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's back on the iPhone.
Oh, nice.
And that's definitely one I missed. I came in just around the NES, so I definitely missed the Atari 2600 section.
My grandmother actually had one, and all we had for it was Donkey Kong, and one, it was Battleship or something. It was just like these two little tanks, and you could fight each other. But I would play the heck out of Donkey Kong. There's only two levels, but that was it. I loved it.
Yeah.
I thought there were like four levels in Donkey Kong.
Oh, not on the Atari one. I think there were only two.
Oh, okay, yeah, because I remember a screen. Oh, yeah, because I played the Nintendo version, where I was like, how high can you go? And it's like 25, 50, 75.
Yeah.
But, anyway, I just found it here. It's Atari's Greatest Hits on the iPhone, and it's actually free.
Oh, cool.
And then, yeah, you can buy, like, a pack of four for about 99 cents, or you can buy all 99 games for $10.
Yeah. That'd be cool.
So, I might be tempted to buy that right now. I may or may not be buying that right now.
Uh-oh. When nostalgia hits, it hits hard.
Yeah,
I definitely agree with that. Yeah. But, alright, it looks like we're hitting a little bit over an hour here, and I know it's getting close for some of us to leave the podcast and go to work.
Yeah, unfortunately.
All right, but I want to thank everybody out there for listening to Podcast-tastic. I want to thank everybody at Pure Nintendo for joining me today.
Thanks for having us. It was a blast.
It was. Thanks.
That was a good time. We should do this again sometime. And,
definitely.
I always love to bring you on for more. But stay tuned, everybody, for more episodes of Podcast-tastic in the future, and we will see you later. You guys can say bye too if you'd like.
See you guys.